Last week we finished up talking a little bit about Charles Simeon, and I've noticed that there hasn't been a rush on tickets for the library day. So just to let you know, there are some still available, so you can go and get them online after this. Charles Simeon was a member of King's College, Cambridge. He went up there in 1779. And that's a college founded in 1441 by Henry VI, and it has particular privileges. One of the privileges that Simeon would have enjoyed as his forebears at King's College was that the students at King's were allowed to get their degrees without ever having to sit an exam. I think it's the only one in Oxford or Cambridge that had that rule. And then they also had the privilege, which they still have, of walking to graduation in front of all the other colleges who did have to do exams. They'd go in, take precedence. So you just go along and you'd go there for a while, and after a little while you'd say, yeah, I think I'm ready for my degree. They'd say, sure, you can have it. No exams. I wonder if you think more college should work on the same model. That might be something to take up with the principal after. Why do we have tests? Why do we have tests at college? Why do we have tests at school? More particularly, why does God give us tests? What's the purpose of God's tests? Why is life so hard at times? I know that in this room, people are going through severe difficulties at the moment. I'm not sure what your particular difficulty is, but I know many people are going through difficulties, difficult relations with parents, parents who are unwell, difficult relationships that people have, children that are a cause of heartache, let alone personal difficulties, a mounting college workload, health that's failing, a crisis of faith. We face difficulties. One of my little bugbears is when people say, oh, when the students of Moore College get into the real world. And I think people here face real challenges. People's lives, they're facing quite desperate and acute difficulties. You might be feeling right now that there's something on the horizon that you just don't know how you're going to face. We are in the real world. We are in the real world here. And sometimes we feel it is too hard. But why is it so hard? That's our question we're thinking about. How are we going to get through it? How are we going to get through it? We're back in the Old Testament today, Exodus chapter 16. And I begin by making a public apology. Last week, I may have slandered my learned colleague, Dan Wu, Reverend Dr. Dan Wu, suggesting that his knowledge of Exodus just involved the movie Exodus, God and Kings, and he castigated me after chapel, saying he has also seen the Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston. So, little preface, I'm not familiar with those scholarly works, but I've been reading the text, and I find us in Exodus chapter 16, we're in a period of the book in between the Red Sea and Mount Sinai. Chapter 15, 22 through to chapter 19, we're in this journey from the Red Sea to Mount Sinai. And in just the paragraph before where we pick up, in Exodus chapter 15, verse 22, we see that the people are on a difficult journey. Just 3 days after they've left the Red Sea, they don't have any water, and they find a pool of water, but it's bitter, and they grumble. And then God provides for them miraculously. And in verse 25, he says that he will test them by his ordinances. And then that brings us to chapter 16, which is a month and a half after the Red Sea. And they're in the wilderness, the people, and the Israelites realize that there are no takeaways. It might be hard for us to imagine. Many of us live in Newtown, you know, Thai restaurant, every kind of restaurant. Domino's directly opposite. I saw on the news a couple of months ago that Domino's had reported a record profit because of unexpected sales results in the second half of last year, coinciding just when our family moved opposite, surprisingly. But it's hard for us to believe. what that would be like. But the case for the Israelites, no takeaways, and they didn't have any food. Well, they didn't have any food. Well, that was their complaint anyway. But there's two things that I think are wrong with this complaint. First of all is their remembering of life before, where they say that they sat around pots of meat in Egypt. And that seems to be just such a false memory, doesn't it? We've been reading through the story of Exodus, and there's no account of pots of meat their time there. They seem to have forgotten bricks without straw. They've forgotten throwing their sons into the Nile. They have a false memory of what life was like back there. But secondly, I think it's a bit of a false problem, no food. Do you remember how they left Egypt back in chapter 12? I understand years 2 to 4, they missed those lectionary readings. I hope you've caught up. But if you've missed them, they left chapter 12, verse 38, along with a huge number of livestock, both flocks and herds. That's how they left. And then in the chapter after our one, chapter 17, verse 3, they're complaining again, and they say, "We've come out of Egypt. Did we come out of Egypt? Did you bring us out to kill us and our children and our livestock?" And then as they head into the promised land in Deuteronomy chapter 3, Moses is talking to them and he's telling them how to go in. And he says, he tells them what to do with their wives and young children and livestock, of which there's a parenthesis where he says, "I know that you have a lot of livestock." Okay? Now, they have a lot of livestock with them. Now, I had a choice in high school of whether to do Latin or agriculture. And I chose to sit in the garden. And I've often regretted that choice, particularly with my vocation. Latin would be helpful. But I come to this passage, and I can tell you categorically, with the authority of a high school agriculture student, that livestock is for food, all right? It's not for looking at. It's not to keep as pets. Livestock is for food. And these people, in many ways, are being self-deceptive in their complaint. This is an important thing, I think, for us to pick up. Sometimes we can be very self-deceptive in the way we see the world. We can be self-deceptive in our problems. In the book Affluenza about Australian society, written about 10 years ago, Clive James quotes a survey where he says 62% of Australians say that they don't have enough money for the things they need. And a staggering 46% of the top 20% of income earners say that they don't have enough money for the things they need. Almost half of the wealthiest people in the wealthiest country in the world think they don't have enough for the things they need. That's the kind of self-deception in our society, and we can fall prey to this self-deception ourselves. We can deceive ourselves about our situation. I wonder how you might fall prey to this yourself. I'm too poor to be generous. I'm too busy to pray. Now, these are the kinds of self-deceptions that we can speak to ourselves. But as bad as self-deception is, there's something far worse going on here, and that is unbelief. We see this in verse 2. The entire Israelite community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. They grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and this demonstrates their faithlessness in God. And they even say to Moses and Aaron, "You brought us into this wilderness." In that very claim, they've forgotten the story. They've forgotten their life just a month and a half before. Who brought them out? Was it Moses and Aaron? No, it was the Lord who brought them out. And yet they're living their lives as if there was no God, as if God doesn't care. And they complain about this. Moses diagnoses this problem, verses 7 and 8. He says to them at the end of verse 8, just a summary, "Who are we? Your complaints are not against us, but against the Lord." They were completely faithless, the people of Israel. And yet, in their faithlessness, God provides for them. It's a gracious provision. Verse 4, "I am going to rain bread from heaven for you is what the Lord says. And he does. Manna and quail provided for them every day. Verse 13, that's exactly what happens onwards throughout the rest of the chapter. That's what they get. Manna in the morning, quail in the evening. They go out and collect it. It will be enough. They collect twice as much on the Fridays. They'll have enough for the next day, on the Saturday. You see here, it's God who saved them, God who sustains them. It's all God. It's a gracious provision. They don't deserve this, but God gives it to them. It's also a generous provision, I think. I used to think manna would be pretty ordinary kind of stuff. When I was a kid in primary school, my mum put us on all kinds of different diets. She was a doctor, and she was getting into dietary stuff, and she experimented on us. And one of them was, I don't know if it was gluten-free or something, but I remember for months having to just eat plain rice cakes at lunch. I don't know if you ever had the, you know, hello taste. Everyone else had meat pies and, you know. Anyway, I thought manna was like that. But we read in verse 31, the house of Israel named the substance manna. It resembled coriander seed, was white, and tasted like wafers made with honey. Now, these are the ancient equivalents of honey smacks they got to have every morning. Every morning. That's, we only get that kind of cereal when we're on holidays, but they got it every day. It was a wonderful, gracious, and generous gift that God was giving them. And I think in this, you know, this taste of honey, they were getting a foretaste of where God was taking them to, a land flowing with milk and honey. And as they go on this journey, they have a foretaste. Now, the thing that really struck me about this passage was that God is testing them. He's testing them. But the test is not in the hardship, but it's in the provision. Will you trust my word? Verse 4, this way I will test them to see whether or not they will follow my instructions. It's not being in the wilderness that's the test. It's how they're going to respond to the provision of God. It's how you respond to his gift that is the test. Will you trust my provision? God asks them. Will that be enough for you? Will you obey my word? Is what he's putting to them. And some, they gather too much and it goes all rotten and smelly, a bit like my brother's school bag at the end of term because he never ate his lunch. Mum would pull out these sandwiches from various stages of rotting. And then some would not gather enough before the Sabbath and then there would be none there. They didn't trust. But that was the test. The test is not in the hardship, it's in the provision. Will you respond to my word in faithfulness? Will you believe in me? The test was in the provision for his people. But what was the purpose of this provision? Why did God give them this bread from heaven? Why did he give them this test? Well, again, we see in this passage, it's not to fill their tummies. Well, not primarily anyway. It's not to stop them complaining. The reason that God gives them this, verse 12, he says, at twilight you will eat meat, and in the morning you will eat bread until you are full. Then you will know that I am Yahweh your God. Where have we heard that before in this story? As we've been reading through the book of Exodus, the whole way along, God has been wanting to show Pharaoh, and I am the Lord, your God. He's wanting to show the Israelites, I am the Lord, your God. And all of those signs were to show, I am the Lord, your God. And now he's done all that. He's brought them out. He's saved them. And having saved them, what does he want to show them? I am the Lord, your God. I am your God. It's what they've forgotten, even after their salvation, but it's what they need to know as they press on. And so God graciously and generously gives them a test, but the test is not an assessment. It's not for assessment, it's for learning. It's to teach them something. That's the point of the test, that they will know the Lord their God. That's been the story of Exodus. Yes, their complaint to Moses was that you brought us out of Egypt, which demonstrates that they had forgotten who their God was. But God, in his kindness, gives them this provision so that they might know him again. As they trust in the provision, they'll know God better. Well, the last thing we see in this passage is that, a little bit like we saw last week, in the provision, last week we saw in the salvation, God provides a way of remembering this gift that he's given them. Verse 33, he tells them to preserve some of this manna. It was symbolic. They were supposed to remember this provision for them. Remember the lesson that they learnt in the test. Just like those things that were instituted, the Passover meal, the Feast of the Unleavened Bread, those things, they would remember the salvation. Now they would remember the sustenance as they carried with them from here on the manna bread, wherever they went. This rescue from Egypt was all of God, and this journey is all God. And of course, taking this bread with them was important. Of course, the bread points forward. It's symbolic bread. It points forward to Jesus. And we're reminded in this passage of Jesus being in a wilderness in John 6, a deserted place. And there are a multitude of hungry people there too. And he miraculously fed them. And then soon after that, in John chapter 6, we read that the people came to Jesus and they were asking him, and Jesus answered them in verse 26, "I assure you, you are looking for me not because you saw the signs, but because you ate the loaves and were filled. Don't work for food that perishes, but for food that lasts for eternal life, which the Son of Man will give you, because God the Father has set his seal of approval on him." "What can we do to perform the works of God?" they asked. Jesus replied, "This is the work of God, that you believe in the one he has sent." One thing, trust the provision. Trust the provision. "What sign then are you going to do that we may see and believe you?" they asked. "What are you going to perform? Our fathers ate manna in the wilderness. Just as it is written, he gave them bread from heaven to eat." Jesus said to them, "I assure you, Moses didn't give you bread from heaven, but my Father gives you the real bread from heaven. For the bread of God is the one who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world." And they said, "Sir, give us this bread always." "I am the bread of life," Jesus told them. "No one who comes to me will ever be hungry. No one who believes in me will ever be thirsty." Today we've been thinking about testing. And we've seen that God does test his people. But the tests are not in the hardship. It's in the provision, how you'll respond to the provision. It's a question of, will you trust in the provision? As we live our lives, we each will experience pendulum swings of fortune. Some of us right now will be in a season of great times. Others of us will be low. But one thing's for sure, we will all be brought low, and we need to know how to get through that time, how to get through the time of testing. Whatever season we're in, we're called to trust in the provision. Do you know enough of the promises of God to follow? Will you cling to the promises of God in the hard times, in the good times? Will you follow his word? Because the purpose of the testing is that you might know him better. It might not surprise you that King's College Cambridge has never actually had a very high academic standing. It's gone down severely in recent years when I went there. Without a test, you don't learn. And so God graciously gives tests. not for assessment, but for growth. For growth. He tests us so we might know him better. And the question is, when we go through the hard times, will you trust the promise? And the next verse, verse 37 of John, Jesus says this, "Everyone the Father gives me will come to me, and the one who comes to me I will never cast out." Again, I venture into territory that is not my own, but as I read this last night, "Umer ekbelo exo." Umer plus the subjunctive, I remember this. I will never, ever, ever cast them out. And the one who comes to me, I will never, ever, ever cast out. That's the promise we have. That's the great gift that God gives us. Let's cling to it.